Up in Farley Green, there was a house called Smuggler's Way. It seemed rather a fanciful name, as smuggling is usually thought of in connection with the sea. Anyway, Mrs. Evatt, who lived there, was asked about it, and she said that her husband had given the house that name because he understood that Kipling's poem, A Smuggler's Song, had been written about the hidden lane which runs behind the house, that is, Ride Lane. It's rather a long poem, but it has a splendid, rollicking chorus. I expect you all know your Kipling by heart, but in case I'm not the only one who doesn't, I'll just read you one verse. If you wake at midnight and hear a horse's feet, don't go drawing back the blind or looking in the street. Them as asks no questions isn't told a lie. Watch the wall, my darling, while the gentlemen go by. 25 ponies trotting through the dark, brandy for the parson, baccy for the clerk, laces for a lady, letters for a spy. And watch the wall, my darling, while the gentlemen go by. Then on another occasion, a neighbour, Mr. Martin, happened to mention that on a clear day, or indeed night, you can see right down to Shoreham Gap from the Windmill Inn above Ewhurst. And this, he said, had been a signalling point for smugglers, that the stuff was on its way. So there must be something in this business of smuggling up in Farley Green, and one might be able to follow some of the routes through the area. The first snag was the very first sentence in the first book that was found on the subject. It is noticeable, it said, that as soon as the smuggler has eluded the Coast Guard, he passes as quietly and expeditiously as possible up the country, intent only on getting his goods to the best market. Publicity is no aid to his labours, and it is not surprising that few records exist of his passage or resting places. Not very encouraging. But luckily we find that he does leave records of a sort, even if they can't always be proved. For what is certainly lacking in documentation is richly made up for in legend and hearsay and local traditions, and of course place names. The southern counties of England are criss-crossed with lanes and tracks actually called Smuggler's Way. And the late Mr. Day of Albury affirmed that we have one of these, coming across from Blackheath and up Sandy Lane, which was always known as Smuggler's Bay. And then there are more specific place names, such as Packway and Searchwood Copse, which no doubt refer to dramas of long ago that can easily be imagined. Wherever these tracks and places occur, there are usually people living nearby who remember their fathers and grandfathers telling tales of things they had heard of, or actually seen, stories that can take us back by word of mouth, way back over 100 years, right into the heyday of the smuggling trade. The smugglers started from many different ports and coves. They used only pack horses for transport, and were therefore very flexible in their movements. For obvious reasons, they kept shifting and changing their tracks. Sometimes two would run parallel, or branch out simultaneously in two different directions, to join up again later. And we may suppose that hitherto friendly cottage suddenly became unfriendly or dangerous, or a whole area came under suspicion from the excisemen and was bypassed for a time. But however the ways changed, there is considerable agreement in all the writers and all the legends that a goodly group of smugglers certainly passed through this area. They would come up from the coast, through our own lanes on the way to London, and you would think it possible to draw a little map of the route. But this presents a problem, for if we can do it, then doubtless an expert exciseman could have done it with much greater ease 100 or so years ago, and put pay to the smuggler's trade in no time at all. Nevertheless, they would ride up into the Hurtwood the same night, writes Gertrude Jekyll, 25 miles as the crow flies, and goodness knows how many more as the smuggler lurks. They got up to the wooded heights either by Jelly's Hollow, or Horseblock Hollow, or up by the Windmill Inn, which was a favourite meeting place in the middle of many tracks. This inn was then known as the New Inn, and it had a false roof for hiding smuggled goods. The whole area, she says, was a very wild and lonely place. If you lived in a remote cottage around the Hurtwood in those days, and heard an odd thumping and bumping past your door in the night, it might well be a keg of brandy come loose from the pack and rolling down from the heights. And you'd do better not to look out of the window, for there would certainly be a man come soon afterwards to look for it. Or if you spotted an unusually fat man riding by awkwardly on his horse, you could make a guess that he had yards and yards of contraband silk wound round his middle. From the Windmill, the tracks continued either west through Farley Green by Lockhurst Hatch, down Dilton Lane, and Pond's Farm, or by Hound House, from which a tunnel was reputed to lead across country. To Quakers, a house above Peace Lake. Then by Lawbrook. Over Shear Heath. And along Dark Lane. And then they met up with another track that must have gone from another port, possibly Hailing Island, where two-thirds of the population were known to be engaged in, or at least in sympathy with the smugglers' trade. This track came through Godalming, by way of Holloway Hill, over Blackheath, up Sandy Lane, and across the top of Albury Park. There are doubtless many more tracks, some remembered, some lost and long disappeared. But as you can tell, the tracks in this area, from whatever direction, all seem to be heading for Shear. The White Horse Inn in Shear seems to have provided a most congenial atmosphere for the weary smugglers on their first leg up to London. It was frequented by sheep stealers, poachers, and other friendly folk with whom they could feel relaxed and at home, and more or less safe from sudden attack. R.J. Askew, author of Walks and Talks About Shear, remembers in his book some of the names and doings of these wild folk. Billy Hicks, who lived in Chantry Lane, cut off his donkey's ears and tail. And also his goats. I can't imagine why. It doesn't seem a very practical thing to do, but perhaps he had been celebrating a good haul. Anyway, he ended up by hanging himself. Then there was Black Jack and the Bristows, at least one of whom was transported to Australia for sheep steering. Mr. Askew had himself talked to an old man who had actually seen the smugglers ride by his house in the night with kegs slung over the saddle. Not only was the White Horse in a friendly place, but almost the whole of Shear Village seemed to have been most cooperative. And many of the old houses in Upper Street have cellars of disproportionately large for their size. And these were most likely specially constructed for the convenience of the smugglers. In case somebody might think this is only hearsay, let me remind you that as recently as 1955, whilst the brewers were delivering casks into the cellars at the White Horse, in the normal fashion, via the chute, one cask hit the adjacent wall and caused some structural damage. The nature of the damage was such that it led to the discovery of the second cellar, which had been bricked up for at least 200 years. Possibly as long as 250 years. Within this old cellar they found many casks of brandy, almost certainly smuggled, and dating from around 1720. Of course there were a few honest people, even around Shere. Peaceful, farming folk, not looking for trouble. And if one of these came by chance upon the hiding place of a smuggling hall, it was the custom for him to put a chalk mark on two or three items. And these items would be left behind when the smugglers moved on next day. This was an understood bargain, in consideration of the find not being reported. But I think it was more of a goodwill gesture, really, because few would have taken the risk of informing anyway. It was too well known that smugglers had nasty little ways of making you not talk, such as being found floating face down in the mill pond next day. I should pause a moment here, perhaps, to say that this tale could be called The Smugglers of Shere, Peaslake, Ewhurst, Cranley, Farley Green. But nowhere is there a mention of Albury. Whether they were a more virtuous and law-abiding lot than the rest of us, I don't know. But they seem to have been constantly bypassed in favour of the wild people of Shere, and more particularly the perfectly dreadful people of Peaslake. 100 years ago, says Gertrude Jekyll, writing at the turn of the century, it was a very rough and lawless set of people that lived in the hamlet of Peaslake, that lies in the north hollow of the Hurtwood, and in the scattered cottages of the neighbouring forest land, a tract from 6 to 7 miles long. They were descendants of wandering gypsy people, all smugglers and poachers and the terror of the quiet farm people round about. They were known to be so awful that if the law were after a malefactor, it were wiser to give up the pursuit should he reach Peaslake. For there abide such a wild population of smugglers, poachers, and sheep-stealers herded together, that it were not safe for an honest citizen to come near. The father of the late Mr. Chennell of Farley Green remembered his father telling him he'd better not try talking to a Peaslake man, or he's likely to get his face slapped. And, of course, it's by no means sure that the people of Peaslake have mended their ways, for it's not so many years ago that it was to unrepentant Peaslake that erring suffragettes fled to hide out from the law. Mackie's Hill House at Peaslake is particularly interesting in that the original part of the house, which dates back to approximately 1610, still has a large cellar and a hide hole, which apart from its early association with smuggling, in more recent years is reputed to have served as a refuge for Emily Pankhurst and other members of the suffragette movement. I should imagine that Shere was the convivial gathering place and business centre where loads could be assessed and subdivided, where news of the situation further up the road could be brought, and possible markets and deals negotiated. And if any sudden trouble blew up, the smugglers could quickly scatter and take refuge with the Peaslake people, where they were pretty sure no excess man in his right mind would follow. This area must have been one of the last havens on the road to London. Another such exists at Newdigate, where the Bell Inn has large cellars, which can still be approached by tunnels from outside. This can be said of many old inns in the area. Some of the tunnels run a fair way right out into the surrounding heath or woodland. Some time ago there was a programme on Blue Peter Children's Television all about the Talbot at Ripley, which still has a smuggler's hide and an escape tunnel. And the camera followed along the hidden passages with suitable music and pictures of smugglers, and it was all very realistic and dramatic. The nearer the gentlemen their contraband got to London, the greater the risks become, the better organized the men of the law. Here the paths split up, in deference, I suppose, to demand as well as danger. Now loads had to be split up into even smaller units, destined for specific buyers. And a more sophisticated organization afforded the smugglers facilities on big estates and houses and even palaces. When the old palace of Nonsuch was destroyed, a maze of tunnels was laid open, leading from the surrounding woods into the enormous cellars where the big business of smuggling was known to have been carried on. There are many weird stories of galloping horsemen on misty nights being hotly pursued right up to the very gates of some fine house and then simply disappearing into thin air. Or a crowd of riders, again with the law behind them, clattering into one end of a main street, but never coming out the other. We may draw our own conclusions as to the supernatural explanations of these going on, and also about the honesty of the local citizens, and even their lord of the manor. It suited the smugglers very well to keep their reputation as spooky as possible. A story is told about Cranley Churchyard, that kegs of brandy were often hidden there in a large altar tomb. One night, a band of brave fellows decided to keep watch and hid themselves in the church porch. But what with the long wait and the eerie night, by the time the sounds of what might be smugglers were heard, they were too terrified to look, let alone move to apprehend the villains. And when they did look again, the loot was gone. To say a little bit in general about the trade, as it was known, the smugglers of our particular area must be seen as part of a chain so loosely linked and forged of such doubtful material that it is incredible how efficiently and for how great a time, well over 200 years, it functioned. The whole business divided itself into two distinct halves, the professionals and the part-time workers, and neither could have operated without the other. Down at the coast were the actual sailing smugglers, the typical seamen, whose business ended the moment the stuff was safely ashore and stored in temporary hiding places. They were really not so brave and daring as you might imagine, because they were protected by hordes of riders who were simply none too fussy local lads who turned out for the occasion armed with every kind of bloodthirsty weapon, short of firearms. The penalty if caught with the latter was death. It was well nigh impossible for a lonely exciseman patrolling the coast to get near and stay healthy. And if he rode off for help, by the time he got back it was all over. From the seashore, the regular land gangs took over, loaded the goods onto pack horses, and travelled with them up country all the way till they were finally sold. These, in their turn, were supported and protected by local people in every region that the contraband passed through. And so it may be seen that by far the largest groups in the smuggling chain were the amateurs. And none among these were more spirited than ours. The eagerness of ordinary country people to join in this dangerous illegal sport is not really so surprising. In the early 1800s, there were whole sections of the community who could hardly have survived without poaching and smuggling. These were the farm labourers, whose conditions of life were so depressed that without the little they made on the side helping the smugglers, they would almost certainly have starved. A bad landlord could, if he wished, lay off his labourers after the harvest and leave them for the winter without even the few pence they normally earned. Around this time, the population of Surrey was about 270,000 souls, and of this 270,000, there were 40,000 paupers on parish relief. That is almost 15%. You can tell how desperate these poor people were when you recall that the punishment for poaching a rabbit or stealing a sheep could be life imprisonment, deportation, or worse. The conditions hereabout that made it a haven for smugglers led eventually to the mob rising of 1830, when a great crowd of starving local labourers poured into Dorking, burning ricks, attacking houses and people, and then went storming on to Guildford to the town hall, demanding justice. In following the actual smugglers' paths further, it is noticeable that many times they lay through great parks and estates, running close by the house itself, which must have afforded them considerable protection. One such is Lyne House at Capel, home then of the Broadwood family, where a special stone receptacle still stands on which the grateful passing smuggler would leave a keg. One wonders why such people, who are not exactly hard up for a gallon of brandy, should give such protection to the trade. It might well have been out of sympathy for the hard lot of the people, and indeed this particular family does seem to have been of a humane turn of mind, for it was a magistrate Broadwood who, by his gentle persuasion and the high esteem in which the people held him, managed to quell the mob uprising of 1830 without more harm being done. While many had sympathy for, as well as considerable financial interest in the smugglers, no one seems to have had a kind word to say for the unfortunate exciseman. Dr. Johnson, in his dictionary, has one of his famous censorious definitions on the subject. "Excise," he says, "a hateful tax levied upon commodities, and adjudged not by the common judges of property, but by wretches hired by those to whom excise is paid." Which was hardly just, considering the lonely and dangerous job the excise man was doing, usually against impossible odds, and many of these unlucky officers of the law suffered most horribly at the hands of the worser gangs, if it seemed they were getting over-curious. There were two main groups of smuggling gangs along the south coast, and it would be nice to tell you that our lot were more pleasant than the others. But alas, I'm afraid this is far from the case. In England, writes Percy Lane Oliver in an old copy of the Surrey Magazine, there were in those days two distinct sets of smugglers, the Devon and Cornwall group, and the Kent, Surrey, Sussex bands, between whose methods a wide difference existed, which difference all good Surrey men will regret to hear was not to the credit of the Eastern system and its adherents. "To the credit of the Cornishmen," says another writer, "let it be recorded that smuggling was conducted in a far more chivalrous spirit than that which characterised the trade further east. There was none of that reckless disregard for life which produced so much bloodshed along the coasts of Kent and Sussex. While Cornish smugglers never disgraced their manhood by acts of brutal and ruffianly outrage, such as those which, alas, disfigured the annals of certain eastern counties." And he gives two examples, the first of which, he says, is completely authentic, the writer having had it from an old tar in a South Cornish town. It goes thus. One of the above gentry, a preventative officer, who had rendered himself particularly obnoxious, had, in an unguarded moment, ventured to strike up a chat with two strapping fisher lasses. On parting, he shook hands with one, who returned his pressure so warmly, employing an old Cornish wrestling dodge, that he suddenly found himself lying on his face with 12 stone of blushing maidenhood sitting on his back. The men of the village were not far off, and the poor prisoner, bound, gagged, and blindfold, soon had the doubtful pleasure of hearing his coming fate discussed in bloodthirsty language. This was soon decided, and he learned with despair that he was to be allowed to hang by his hands until he dropped from a cliff shelving inwards down onto the rocks 80 feet below to certain death. Guessing that appeals would be useless, he determined to die game. And presently found himself dangling in mid-air by a precarious hold on the herbage growing on the cliff edge. A short lifetime passed by, and his strength being exhausted, he was at length forced to leave go, and fell. A drop of only 18 inches. It had been a got-up job all through, but it had its effect, for he never showed his face in that town again. This story contrasts most favourably with one told of the notorious Hawkhurst gang, which passed back and forth frequently through our area here. Two men, William Galley, a customs house officer, and one Daniel Chater, a shoemaker, and witness to a recent smuggling outrage, alighted one evening at the White Hart Inn and called for refreshments. They never did a more ill-advised thing in their lives, but they added to their foolishness by chatting to Mrs. Payne, the landlady, and inquiring the way to the notary where they were to swear out information. Widow Payne's suspicions being aroused, she sent for her two sons, who were themselves wholly addicted to smuggling, and the village was aroused. Then the men's fate was decided upon. They were made drunk and put to bed till dark. Then they were taken out and set on the back of a horse, their feet tied under its belly. The character of their captors was now made manifest. These fiends commenced to lash them with heavy whips till they swooned, and so often as they fell over, striking their heads against the horse's hooves, so were they picked up and forced to continue. At length, finding them too weak to stay upright any longer, they were undone and laid across the horses in front of the riders, who tortured them to such a degree that Galley in vain implored them several times to shoot him through the head. Reaching a village, they buried Galley in a sand pit, and there was revealed later strong evidence that he was still alive at the time. Chater's sufferings, however, were not yet at an end. There are many versions of this part of the story, and I'm afraid none of them is fit to read out. Let us just say that quite the kindest thing they did to poor Daniel Chater was finally to throw him headfirst down a well and chuck rocks and pieces of timber on top of him until every sign of life was hushed. Then they rode away. This then was called the Golden Age of Smuggling. The running of contraband had become just about the largest business in the south of England, and those engaged in it exercised a total tyranny in the peaceful countryside, impervious to the law. And it lasted all of 200 years, almost into the 20th century. And it all began in England in a very small way, back in the 13th century, when Edward I had the bright idea of raising a little cash on just a few items coming into the country. It really got underway during the wars with France, when normal trade between the two countries came to a standstill. English men and women still wanted their brandy and silks regardless of patriotism, and furthermore the French still wanted our wool. For this smuggling was a two-way affair, and throughout the history of smuggling there was a steady trade in English wool. Some of our most attractive West Surrey towns, such as Odiham, were wool towns built on the wealth from this illegal trade. After the wars, instead of resuming free trade, even more tariffs were imposed to pay for it all, till finally the situation became absurd, and by the middle of the 18th century, 12,000 items were dutiable. In fact, there had almost ceased to be any normal trade at all in most of these commodities. For instance, the duty on brandy was 7 shillings a gallon, but you could buy the stuff anywhere around here for only 3 shillings a gallon, which doesn't make much sense. Similarly, the East India Company, which technically had the tea trade monopoly, sold 6 million pounds worth of tea in 20 years. But we were actually drinking 7 million's worth in 1 year, which means that 95% of tea entering the country was smuggled. Since in the end the government was losing more than it gained, trying to protect its revenue, something had to give. And so with the growth of free trade, the duties were gradually removed or diminished until by the end of the 19th century, the 12,000 items were down to barely a dozen of the ones we are familiar with today. Luckily, the decline of smuggling coincided with a slightly more enlightened attitude to workers' wages, or the poor folk of Shear and Peaslake would have found themselves in a very sorry fix. If you want to pick out smugglers' tracks when you're walking about this area, you have only to remember that they were always on the lookout for two conditions: quiet going and good, quick hiding places. And the heath fulfills both these pressing needs beautifully, because it is wild and remote, and because much of it is based on sandstone. Horses' hooves make very little sound on sandstone, and it's soft enough to hollow out small caves, or even enlarge rabbit and fox holes to stuff down a few kegs in an emergency. There's a hollow in the bank up in Ride Lane, which has been used by generations of local children to play in. It's just about big enough for two or three smallish children to crouch in, and the entrance used to be quite well concealed. This may or may not be a genuine hide, but there are other well-attended ones at Compton and Loseley, and further afield at Godston and Reigate Hill. The splendid Miss Jekyll writes, "Some 4 miles from my home, a set of old pack-horse tracks passes near a remarkable smuggler's lair and hiding place. It lies off the track, well concealed in a wood, in private property. It is a region of caves, evidently made of human hands, though probably begun by foxes, in the sandy soil just south of the chalk ridge. Roomy galleries, 8 feet high and as much wide, ramble about underground with ramifications to right and left. Sometimes a glimmer of light shows at the end of one of these and is accounted for by a deep hollow and a hole among the trees above. The labyrinth below has a floor of soft sand and feels warm and dry, even in winter." No doubt it had a second practical exit, and bold indeed must have been the excise man of 100 years ago who ventured down into its depths when they were held by an armed smuggling gang. Similarly, if you know an old house with an unusually large cellar, concealed attic, or space up a big old chimney, there's sure to be a reason for it. Shophouse Farm in Farley Green had a false attic. It was quite small and difficult to get into from a little passage behind a cupboard, and nobody knew what it was doing there. But it seems very likely that it was a hide. The house is certainly old enough, being mentioned in Doomsday, and it backs right onto Ride Lane. And as there is a very similar attic at Middle Farm, not half a mile away, the evidence seems fairly convincing. Ride Lane is a typical smuggler's track, and if you come upon two or even more of these sunken lanes running parallel, this is a likely sign, for when one of these soft paths, as they were called, became impassable or too deep for safety, they would simply start another beside it, and even a third. Another sign that is unaccountable was remarked upon by old Mr. Donkin, who lived at Winterfold Cottage. He said that the big yew tree outside the cottage was a sure sign of smugglers. Similarly, the two used by Dilton's farm, where there used to be a gate. Where there are yews, he said, there have been smugglers. Maybe somebody here knows why this should be so. Mrs. Donkin also always said that Winterfold Cottage was an overnight stop for smugglers, and certainly the old chimney there has a big concealed bake oven inside of it still, and may well have other hidden cavities before modernization. The most exciting tale, however, was told to us by a Mr. Evans about his cottage, Pippin's, up Mackie's Hill in Peaslake. The cottage is perhaps 400 years old, and sometime after he and his wife moved in, they began to notice from time to time a strong smell of fish. Not just vaguely all over the house, but very distinct, sometimes in one place, sometimes another, and always where the smell was also a patch of cold, cold air. Sometimes the smell was just fish, sometimes fish and tobacco. Neither Mr. Evans nor his wife smoked, and they seldom ate fish. Now, Mr. Evans is an architect and not at all a fanciful man, and if he had a fishy smell, he was well placed to find out where it was coming from. He was, in fact, in the process of doing some improvements to the house, and upon investigating in the cellars, he came across the entrance to a tunnel. And this tunnel, like so many others in this neighbourhood, led from the cellar, right out as far as he could follow it, under the woods, and into the countryside. Now, one of the improvements that Mr. Evans had made in the old cottage was to put a big picture window over the sink. And so, when it was dark outside, most of the kitchen could be seen reflected in this window. One evening, as Mrs. Evans was washing up, she felt suddenly cold and smelt fish and tobacco, and she kept quite still because she could see something moving behind her reflected in the window. Obviously, Mrs. Evans was not a nervous or fanciful person either, because she said she kept quite still as she didn't want to frighten it away. After a while, she turned her head very gently, and there, standing behind her, dressed head to foot in the manner of 100 years before, was a sailor. And the smell of fish and tobacco was very strong indeed. It was all over in a matter of moments, but Mrs. Evans had seen him so clearly that she was able to describe his clothes in perfect detail, pea jacket, close-fitting peaked cap and all. And we wondered if he might not be the same sailor that haunts High House here in Shear, the poor ghost that got himself cut in half due to a floor level being altered. There's not much smuggling in these parts now, I suppose, and yet there's still something rather mysterious up in Winterfold and Farley Green. And you may have noticed that when there's something on, like the great train robbery, or the more recent Brixmat bullion robbery at London Airport, out come the helicopters and police cars, and that's where they start searching, as if old custom leads them to suppose that up there in our woods and heathlands is the right and proper place for anyone wishing to keep out of the way of the law to be hiding, even to this day. Finally, how did the smugglers leave this area on their way up to London? Most probably by London Lane. Now, it is a trackway that leads north from the centre of Shear, under the modern bypass road, and on up the hillside to Netley Heath.